or deterrent.
Greetings! Welcome! Bienvenidos! Hola! Aloha! Ni hao! Namaste! Konnichiwa! Bonjour! Buongiorno! Sawadee karab! Guten tag! Ja wivi va kat bang! Half a day! Jai Janendra! Salam! Shalom! Peace! Now! Go vegan! Peace how? Go vegan! From the left coast of the unlabeled, genetically mutated, McNugget pharmaceutical, vivisection prison, kilitary industrial core poor nation, in the cheese-covered post-constitutional, bankster bankrupt corruptocracy, mocracy, criminocracy of the United States of Listeria, foodborne in the NRA, NSA, USA, home of Uncle Sam Manella, where they sure do eat a lot of dead animal body parts, and the Wall Street-backed corporate diet of death, disease, and destruction is shoved down your throat. This is Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden. 'Twas the night before Christmas, when all through the house, not a creature was stirring, not even a mouse. And no mouse was stirring, for each had been killed by the hands of a vivisector with neck-breaking skill. But the vivisector, like HSUS, says, humanely we kill, especially for mice. The most humane way to do it is to kill them all twice. Well, I am most curious about how people do become vivisectors, or concentration camp workers, for that matter. You know, Nazis, how do people gas and break the necks of innocent beings, and how do they slash the throats of cows and pigs and chickens and lambs, and you know, how do they gas people? Anyway, for insight into this, we go to the website I'm sure you visit all the time like I do, modernfarmer.com, and I wonder how well can we brainwash ourselves, huh? Well, there is a feature called Farm Confessional. I bred mice for medical testing from December 19th, 2013. And it says here in our Farm Confessional column, we hear from the workers and other folks involved in animal or agriculture production. Do you have a story to tell? Anonymity is okay and guaranteed. Contact us at edit@modernfarmer.com. For this edition, a current medical student told us about his experience after college working as a mouse breeder and research associate at a scientific laboratory. He preferred to remain anonymous. And the column starts off saying, when I was 21, I had a job breeding mice as a research associate in a basic science laboratory. To get the job, you needed a bachelor's degree in one of the basic sciences, chemistry or biology or so on. But for the day-to-day of the job, none of that was really necessary. You're not really applying those theoretical skills. I started as a research associate, making, with benefits, maybe $35,000 a year. Each day, I would get in at 8 a.m., sterilize myself, gown up, and start looking after the mice. The first thing that greets you is this very special fresh smell of, I'm trying to describe it, like wood chips, urine, and a little mouse feces. It's just how you begin the day. And he says he worked in a standard mouse room, and that it's all about preserving the genetic lines, and let's see, after And let's see, ended up getting called. Okay, so he says, once the mice were in the cages, and I had all the tail clippings, I found which of the mice were useful for the experimentation that we wanted to do. I take the tails, go back to the lab, and do what's called polymerase chain reaction to see if that mouse had the genetic mutation I want. The mice that did, they were removed and put in their own separate cages for the experiments to go on. And the ones that did not, they ended up getting culled. And as you can see right off the bat here, to rationalize, they're not getting killed. Culled seems to be a nice word for mass murder, right? So this is the research associate telling us that the mice are getting culled. He says the culling process, it's not the murdering process, quoting here, the culling process is very heavily regulated, yeah, right? And where I was at, you'd have to kill them twice, effectively, in order to make sure they were completely dead. See, this is what's humane. This is, you know, Humane Society of the United States says it supports humane slaughter. Well, I guess that's why I'm upset with HSUS. It doesn't insist that all animals be killed twice, like the laboratories do. That's the humane way. So the researcher goes on to say, quoting here, the first way you did that is carbon dioxide. Well, wait a second, buddy, the first way I didn't do that. You did that. You should be saying the first way I did that is carbon dioxide. But maybe we're feeling a little too guilty to put it that way. So we'll put it in the second person, right? The first way you did that is carbon dioxide. You took the container with the mouse into a room that had gas tubes in it. You're trained not to induce any additional physical harm or distress to the mice, as if it isn't constant for them anyway. Okay, so there's this very slow, very specific rate. You increase the amount of CO2 in the room. Now, he didn't do it. He was just following orders, right? So he says, they're walking around, they're moving around, and then very, very slowly, they're more sluggish, and then finally, they just kind of fall asleep. I think it's a permanent sleep. Okay, he says, after all of them have stopped moving and you don't see any respiratory movement or breathing, you wait another few minutes or so, and after that, you separate their cervical spine from their head. This is the most grisly part, but it's just to confirm that they are, in fact, dead. You take them by the tail, splay them out flat, and then, using a hard object, you apply a lot of pressure behind the skull and right at the junction of the head and spine. Eventually, there will be a sort of popping sensation or sound, and then you know. Yeah, in the beginning, it definitely was kind of strange, for sure. Just simply that sensation. It was something I had to get used to. But eventually, it became a process of the work we were doing. So, I guess that really explains it right there, huh? I mean, his morality is telling him one thing. It's kind of strange, you know, going against his morality and killing innocent beings like that. But, you know, it's something you get used to. It's part of the process. We're just following orders. Everybody does it. The men in the white coats tell us it's okay, right? So he says, any individual who does this has to find a reason or a justification why they think it's important. Well, maybe the $35,000 yearly salary was important to this person, huh? He says, obviously, it's been heavily politicized, and people can view this from a lot of different perspectives. I think the mice view it from one particular perspective. I think looking at the scope of animal research and the benefits humanity has accrued and gained as a result of animal models, to me, it's all worth it. So here you have somebody who is just totally brainwashed into the system, right? And can rationalize, and you know, we're just following orders, we're just gassing the innocent, we're just, you know, breaking their necks, you know. And I don't know, where is that cure for cancer already, with all the mice over the years? Where's the cure? And then if we hear from real scientists, we hear that you can't extrapolate from mice to humans, and we're giving them false diseases that they don't get in the ways that humans get them. And I think that this researcher is in need of deprogramming, don't you think? I mean, this is very bizarre how we can brainwash ourselves, and I might suggest that he visits Stop Animal Exploitation Now, Sane Online, SAENonline.org, to see, you know, just how the welfare of these animals is treated by the universities. Well, I guess anyone who thinks the humane way to do anything is to kill them twice, you know, has a very bizarre attitude, you know. And when we think of all the drugs that are recalled from the market and the failure rate, it's really very quite bizarre. I was watching a video of Peter Singer, and I think that we're going to discuss that in the second hour with Professor Gary Francione when he does his animal rights commentary. And he just spoke at Harvard and seemed to rationalize the use of mice in experimentation in that talk. I would like to talk to Professor Gary Francione about that. And coming up on today's program, since Christmas is just coming up this coming Wednesday, the question is, was Jesus a vegan animal rights activist who engaged in the first ALF direct action? Well, I will pose that question to noted vegan historian and author Rin Berry, who is coming up shortly here on Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden. I want to talk about how SeaWorld seems to be tanking. Everybody seems to be abandoning the bathtub. I want to get to that today on Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden. And how really it's at this point, feeding chicken to children has to amount to child abuse when you judge the contamination and all. Hey, please support the program with a tax-deductible donation. We have to purchase radio airtime, as we've done for 12 years. You can click donate at goveganradio.com, where you can also listen to hundreds of free archives. That's goveganradio.com. Radio with Bob Linden, goveganradio.com, on Twitter at goveganradio. And if you'd like to advertise your vegan and cruelty-free products and services, you can email me, bob@goveganradio.com. Well, it seems that everybody is, you know, abandoning bathtub, more and more. SeaWorld seems to be tanking, to be going down. And even in the sense that its major shareholder on December 17th, SeaWorld Entertainment major shareholder Delaware LPSW sold 18 million shares of SeaWorld. It's like dumping this. We can't own this loser, right? After Blackfish, right? So that's $28.88 a share. That was about $520 million, dumping off $500 million in SeaWorld, its major shareholder. Of course, Blackfish is a major reason why. There's this article in the National Geographic Daily News. The headline is "School Children and Musicians Boycott SeaWorld in Blackfish Flap." A field trip is called off and acts cancel gigs in growing controversy. And so it's everyone from fifth graders at Point Doom Marine Science Elementary School in Malibu who have taken an overnight trip to SeaWorld in San Diego every year. But this year, a 10-year-old named Kira Kotler told her parents and teachers she didn't want to go after seeing Blackfish and what happens to the orcas. And in fact, well, her classmates agreed. So, good. No trip to SeaWorld. And then it says, the trip cancellation comes on the heels of announcements by several prominent musicians that they're pulling out of upcoming gigs at SeaWorld parks. Those acts include the Bare Naked Ladies, Martina McBride, Heart, Cheap Trick, Trisha Yearwood, Willie Nelson, and REO Speedwagon. Sounds like bunch of bands I used to play when I was program director at Z92 in Omaha and rock stations around the country. And it's hard to believe that they're canceling gigs because it's hard to believe that they even booked these gigs in the first place, right? Willie Nelson said of his decision, quote, "What they do at SeaWorld is not okay." An understatement, right? On December 7th, sisters Anne and Nancy Wilson tweeted, "Heart has chosen to decline their forthcoming performance at SeaWorld on 2/9/14 due to the controversial documentary film Blackfish." Nancy tweeted, "The SeaWorld show was planned long ago as an Orlando show. Had we known, we'd have said no then, but we said no today. Love you all." Let's see, petitions against it. Oh, on December 11th, rocker Joan Jett wrote a letter to SeaWorld President Jim Acheson objecting to the fact that her song, "I Love Rock and Roll," was being used as the opening music for its cruel and abusive Shamu Rocks show. That's quoting Joan Jett there. She said, "I'm among the millions who saw Blackfish, and I'm sickened that my music was blasted without my permission at sound-sensitive marine mammals," Jett wrote. "These intelligent and feeling creatures communicate by sonar and are driven crazy in the tiny tanks in which they are confined." So, there you have it. It's, you know, really, really impressive that that things are happening. We hope the sooner the better that SeaWorld goes down. And look at the effect that Blackfish had, huh? So, I mean, if you love Blackfish, why not love all fish, right? Stop eating fish. Stop eating all of them, right? You know, I mean, if SeaWorld is upsetting to you, you know, how about Fish Farm World being upsetting to you and trawlers and, you know, the big lines that, you know, catch all the fish, right? So let's love all fish and show them that by not eating them, by going vegan, huh? If you're upset, you know, by SeaWorld, be upset by Meat World. Huh? How about Dairy World and Egg World, Vivisection World, you know? I mean, you know, a documentary can be made about any of these conditions in any of these industries. You know, how about Fur, Wool, Leather, Silk World, Ringling Brothers World, huh? You know, Rodeo World, Hunting World, huh? Okay. All right, we'll continue. It's Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden. GoVeganRadio.com. Vegan Radio with Bob Linden. GoVeganRadio.com. You can support our program with a donation. You know, we've been broadcasting now for, well, it's coming up on our 13th anniversary in January, as heard on Air America and CBS and Clear Channel radio stations, iTunes, Stitcher.com. And we do have to purchase radio airtime. And we're looking at returning to WWRL in New York City and WCPT in Chicago, two stations that did carry our program when we were with Air America, when there was an Air America, and it costs money to do so, so you can help us out and help people hear about going vegan and how it's really the only way to save the planet from climate change. I don't know if you were watching, well, it was mainly on Democracy Now!, the coverage in Warsaw, Poland, of the most recent climate summit. And Jeb Sanyo was there. He was the spokesperson, leading the contingent from the Philippines after it had just suffered the typhoon. And he was in tears, and he decided to fast for the cause of climate change. And that was noted as one of the top 10 actions on behalf of climate change. And I've been tweeting to Jeb saying, okay, well, now let's stop the fasting and go vegan to save the planet, because animal agriculture is responsible for at least 51% of all greenhouse gas emissions. And I just got a tweet back from Jeb saying, I am vegan. So he is a living example of how we save the planet from climate change. You hear that? Jay-Z and Beyonce, stay with it, go vegan. And Jay-Z saying it's for spiritual reasons. That means let's get rid of the fur, Beyonce, okay? So 22 days for the 44th birthday, let's make it permanent. And somebody asked me to give a shout out to mannerrelief.org, providing vegan nutrition to children in need around the world, doing so for many years. Mannarelief.org, M-A-N-N-A, relief.org. So I am happy to welcome the return of Rin Berry to Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden. Rin did his undergraduate and graduate work at the University of Pennsylvania and Columbia with a major concentration in ancient studies. He is the historical advisor to the North American Vegetarian Society and the author of The New Vegetarians, Famous Vegetarians, Food for the Gods, Vegetarianism, and the World's Religions, Hitler, Neither Vegetarian Nor Animal Lover, Becoming Raw, The Essential Guide to Raw Vegan Diets with Brenda Davis and Vesanto Molina, and The Vegan Guide to New York City. Rin has been prolific in his writing and playwriting, and just is looked to as an authority. You know, Rin, we may have to look at the words vegetarian and vegan in a historical perspective soon, I might add. There seems to be a lot going on in that arena.
Yeah, well, I mean, certainly veganism is it come into its own. It was an obscure term when it was first coined in 1944, but now it's fair to drive out a vegetarian.
Well, yeah, I mean, did vegetarian mean vegan in the past? I mean,
originally, of course, in the West, the term of art for someone who abstained from animal flesh was the word Pythagorean, named after the great philosopher and mathematician, geometer, Pythagoras.
Mm-hmm. What is that, C squared equals A squared plus B squared? Am I close?
And a right triangle.
I'm just trying to remember Stuyvesant High School. I remember Pythagoras, but I didn't remember anybody saying he had a special, style of eating.
That's right. Well, that's suppressed. But in fact, he was a man of many parts. Not only was he a geometer and philosopher, but who founded the prototype of the modern university, but he was also a wrestling coach who produced champions, probably the greatest athlete who ever lived.
Oh, really? Maybe Austin Aries may be able to get some look at his history. Austin Aries, the wrestler who was on the show a few weeks ago, champion wrestler who's vegan.
I mean, they all follow the Pythagorean system, which was largely a raw food, vegan diet.
Really?
All the coaches in the ancient world,
Ah, very interesting. Yeah, and weren't the gladiators to an extent?
They were vegans as well. They were known as the barley men because they subsisted principally on barley, on soaked barley grains.
And it's so amazing that so many of the athletes, who high performance athletes even of today, are vegan. You know, with the Williams sisters, and in contact sports too. I mean, you know,
It used to be the endurance sports like Scott Jurek's. You know, the ultra marathoner who's the current record holder, and he's a vegan. He's even written an autobiography in which he intersperses the text with vegan recipes.
That's what's and well, we say that the word vegan came to us in the 1940s from Donald Watson.
Donald Watson and his wife. People often omit to mention Dorothy Watson, who was a partner in the enterprise of coining the new term.
Mm-hmm. And why did he see the need for a term vegan at that time, do you think?
Well, because too many vegetarians were consuming eggs and dairy. And he said, we want to address the egg and dairy issue. And so he wanted to refine the term vegan to encompass only the eating of fruits and vegetables and the wearing of non-animal fibers.
Fruits,
so that's
vegetables.
Why they coined the term. They just took the first and last syllable of vegetarian and telescoped them together.
And cut out the crap in the middle. The T-shirt has said, you know. So
So he lived to a great age. I think he died when he was about 96.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah, being vegan was very good for him. It's interesting that, and it does get overlooked sometimes, like you said, with Pythagoras. I know with Cesar Chavez, I often go speak at Cesar Chavez events, and you know, on his birthday, and if he were alive today, there wouldn't be anything he could eat at the event celebrating his birthday. Nobody says anything about his being vegan and concerned for animal rights. So,
same is true of Jesus.
Yeah, so the main question with Christmas coming up on Wednesday, I guess, to ask directly, and people will think I'm crazy with this opposing it this way, but I bet I get a yes answer. Was Jesus a vegan animal rights activist who engaged in the first ALF direct action?
Well, I don't know if it was the first, but it was certainly one of the most significant. I mean,
who might have come before that then? Historically,
Pythagoras himself used to protest animal sacrifice at the temple of Apollo of Delos. He held counter sacrifices, and certainly an animal activist. And the Buddha, Mahavira, they were all animal activists and animal rights proponents who put their lives on the line. Fortunately for them, they didn't pay the ultimate price of being executed, but Jesus did. You know, he was sort of like, he was in the mold of the Buddha, I guess we could call it, similar to a Jewish Buddha, who wanted to reform the diet of the Israelites, and wanted to abolish animal sacrifice in the temple, and he went into the temple and made a scourge of rope and turned over the change the money changers' tables, because they were exchanging foreign currency for the coin of the realm in which they could purchase animals for sacrifice, and then he liberated the animals from the temple and said, "Do not turn my father's house into a meat market," as I've translated it. And then, of course, he was arrested and brought up on charges and summarily executed for being an early harbinger of the modern ALF Animal Liberation Front activist.
Mm-hmm. Which engages in nonviolent activities.
Nonviolent protests. And, I guess the only element of violence would have been the overturning of the tables of the money changers. Mm-hmm. Driving the animals out of the temple, animals from the temple.
One might consider that vandalism, although others might consider that heroic liberation.
Exactly. It wasn't a hanging offense.
Right. Yeah. So we talk about, the word vegan comes into use in the 1940s, but how was it that Jesus would have been vegan then?
Well, I guess he wasn't. He's been described as belonging to the Essenes. Josephus describes the Essenes as being Pythagoreans, so he would have been a Pythagorean, vegan in that sense. That was the term.
But he was actually a vegan, a couple of thousand years before the word came along, basically.
Yeah, exactly. So. And as I often say in my talks, there's nothing novel about veganism. It was coined. It was novel to the Brits and to the Europeans, but not in history. Like in the broad sweep of history, veganism is a very venerable movement.
We will continue. Stay with us. We're talking to historian Rin Berry about Jesus. We'll also talk about Hitler and much more history on veganism. It's Go Vegan Radio with Bob Lind, and you can support the program with a donation. Click donate at goveganradio.com. With Bob Lind and goveganradio.com. If you want to email me, it's bob@goveganradio.com. Twitter @goveganradio. Check out my KPFA commentaries on the Pacifica radio station in the San Francisco Bay Area in the 8 a.m. hour on Wednesdays. It's 94.1 FM. KPFA.org. Well, I archive them at goveganradio.com also, so you can hear them there. Today we're talking to Rin Berry, noted historian and author. And so, Rin, we were talking about Jesus being a vegan, animal rights activist, engaging in direct action, Of course, he was vegan a couple of thousand years before the term came into effect in the 1940s. Why would he have been vegan or a Pythagorean or someone who ate fruits, vegetables, nuts, grains, seeds?
Well, he was born into a sect that was anti-sacrificial and vegan, according to Josephus, the Jewish historian. And they were trying to reform the temple practices introduced by the Aaronites and the Levites. They believed that there had been a vegan Torah. They were trying to restore the vegan Torah, and they believed that the Aaronites and the Levites had corrupted the worship in the temple by introducing animal sacrifice and trafficking in animal flesh.
So there's a movement to restore a vegan Torah. Is that what you're saying? Yes. And what would that be called, or how would people learn about that? Or
well, it's
or just I guess, know, Google that, right? Google
the matter of historical record. Actually, the I guess the greatest historian on that topic is Hans Joachim Schoeps, who you know, puts forward that theory in his book on the Ebionites and the Nazorians.
So Jesus would have been in a scene, but really, it's in the book of Genesis. It's really the first commandment ever is in the book of Genesis, Genesis book 1, verse 29. Then God said, "I give you every seed-bearing plant on the face of the whole earth and every tree that has fruit with seed in it. They will be yours for food," period, end of sentence, end of discussion. Yeah. Where could we go wrong after that? I mean, it's such a definitive statement.
You know? Yeah, that's the prime directive, and we're you know, Jesus, the Essenes are trying to recover the that you know, paradisal existence that, you know, had been, that is prefigured in Genesis.
So it would be paradise on earth if we were vegan, but people then seem to go into and look at the Bible and say that, yeah, but other sections give us, you know, dominion over the animals to where they're all supposed to fear us. And, you know, then there was the flood and God gave permission, you know, maybe reluctantly, but, you know, then come all the excuses, apparently.
Yeah, of course. Well, that according, you know, to scholars who... with a vegan perspective, I mean, that, of course, that was all the corrupted text and interpolations, and that's why the Ebionites were trying to recover the original Torah, which didn't have those imperatives to slaughter animals and sacrifice them.
Where would an original Torah be that would, you know, be a vegan Torah? Where, like,
does... Well, I mean, according to Schoeps, one of the great losses of it has been the Torah that Jesus himself was attempting to recover. You know, that the Ebionites were trying to reconstruct and rid the modern Torah of its false verses and its false
So we're getting, as usual, just a lot of rationalizations for cruelty. We have to take another break. We're with Rin Berry. Let's continue our discussion after the break. Rin Berry on Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden. You can email me. It's bob@goveganradio.com. Donate by clicking donate at goveganradio.com. Twitter at goveganradio. Greetings once again. Welcome back for our second hour. Yes, we have expanded to 2 hours as we are syndicated by the Genesis Communications Network, GCN, and we are live every Sunday from 5 p.m. to 7 p.m. Pacific Time. It's Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden, goveganradio.com, Twitter at goveganradio. You can look for me on Facebook as Bob Linden or Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And, well, where would Jesus shop, I guess? Well, as we have learned from our discussion earlier, and we will continue with Rin Berry, I guess Jesus would be shopping at Viva La Vegan Grocery this time of year, right? I mean, it's the world's largest vegan grocery store with over 6,000 vegan items in Rancho Cucamonga, or Rancho Cucumber Mango, California, and also newly opened in Santa Monica at on Ocean Park at 20. 28th. So check it out, VivaLaVeganGrocery.com. And, you know, what's also ironic is that this coming Wednesday, people are celebrating the birth of a great vegan with food he would not approve, when you consider the holiday ham, the holiday turkey, the honey. That's honey-baked ham's largest sales day of the year, and people walking out with the round little body bags and, you know, winding up in body bags as a result. But how do we come to that? How is it that Christmas would be celebrated with, you know, ham and turkey and, you know, it's all corrupted, isn't it, Rin?
Yeah, thoroughly. I mean, he would be appalled at the, you know, at the manner in which people are celebrating his birth. I mean, he was born to, he was destined to be an animal liberator and to reform the dietary practices of the the elite and the nouveau riche. And, of course, they've made a travesty of everything he stood for.
Yeah, it's a total mockery. And yet, if the world were reformed in that manner and we were to go vegan, we would be addressing climate change and resource depletion and deforestation and heart disease and cancer and stroke, you know, all of it going along. So, you know, obviously, I mean, people will object to what you're saying at times. And I, you know, when I talk in these terms, people say to me, well, what are you talking about? Jesus ate fish. He fed people fish. And there's a lot about fish going on here.
There's a lot of fish imagery in the Gospels. There's no doubt about it. But we have to remember that fish was also the, you know, it was a symbolic of the movement. Because it coincided with the advent of the age of Pisces. You know, the precession of the equinox, and he was the Anthropoichthus, the fish man, or the herald of the new age. So there's a lot of fish imagery that runs through the Gospels, but not for any reason of eating fish, or, you know, it wasn't on the menu by any means. In fact, and fish, like meat, was a scarce commodity in the ancient world, and wasn't on the many of the average person, you know, couldn't afford animal flesh of any kind. So, yes, I mean, and any of the, you know, I did in my book, Food for the Gods, I debunk the myth that Jesus fed the multitudes with fish. And actually, I studied Greek for 8 years in college and graduate school, and I still read it for recreation, and I translated the passage in the Gospel of John, in which supposedly he fed multitudes with fish. But the word that is used for fish, opsaria, means the first meaning of opsaria is relish, and only the fourth meaning is little fish. So it was really mistranslated. The term opsaria derives from opson, which means dessert or relish in Homeric Greek, and opsaria means relish. So, I mean, that would make far more sense. I mean, for him to be multiplying loaves of bread and relish, you know, because that's how people dined in the ancient world. They would take a bread, which was very nutritious, and tear off a piece and dip it into the opson, or the opsaria, and then eat it. I mean, it was
and
like
the relish,
pickled
the relish?
Olives or tahini. They would dip the bread into the opson, and then...
Yeah, I was just going to ask, what would the relish be? So you say what, pickled olives, tahini, et cetera, things like
yeah,
that?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Exactly. Okay. That was
Okay.
Condiment that enhanced the flavor of bread.
Mm-hmm. We're talking to Rin Berry, who is the historical advisor to the North American Vegetarian Society and the author of The New Vegetarians, Famous Vegetarians, Food for the Gods, Vegetarianism, and the World's Religions, Hitler, Neither Vegetarian Nor Animal Lover, Becoming Raw, The Essential Guide to Raw Vegan Diets, and The Vegan Guide to New York City. And his books have been translated Nepalese, German, Italian, Taiwanese, Chinese, Polish, Bulgarian, Hungarian, languages I've never heard before or seen written. So, and you know, contributions to Oxford writings.
Yeah, the Oxford Encyclopedia of American Food and Drink.
Yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. They just published the second edition of its own multi-volume set of the Oxford Encyclopedia of American Food and Drink, and I've written entries on veganism and allied topics.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so, and then, well, we move on to another historical character, one not so highly esteemed, but, you know, people run into you and you say, oh, you're vegan or you're vegetarian, the word that's supposed to mean vegan or doesn't anymore. If somebody says vegetarian now, do you think that means vegan or do you automatically assume animal products just in your mind?
Well, I don't. But Watson, I think Watson's and Dorothy's and his wife Dorothy's criticism was valid. That, you know, it's too elastic a term.
And right. That word now has been compromised so much and hijacked by animal exploitation that they laugh all the way to the bank when someone has a cheese omelet.
I mean, people think that you can eat. Be a vegetarian and still, eat fish, for example.
Right.
Pisco, ovo, polo, vodka, yes. Vegetarian. You know.
But you can eat relish. You can have tahini and pickled olives. So.
Well, that they did. That was the substance of a meal in the ancient world.
Yeah. So, but wasn't Hitler a vegetarian? Nah. So that, diminishes everything. Your whole world collapses now because Hitler was a vegetarian.
Yeah.
Wasn't he? Or vegan, even?
Well, that's often trotted out as a means of discrediting vegetarianism. When I wrote my book, Famous Vegetarians, I was constantly being heckled by hostile non-vegetarians. I said, well, what about Hitler? Why didn't you include him in your book, Famous Vegetarians? And of course, that prompted me to research the matter, and I did for several years, and I discovered that, in fact, he was not a vegetarian by any stretch of the imagination, because it's well attested by eyewitnesses that he would eat plenty of vegetables, but then he had a weakness for liver dumplings, for example, and he would always have a meat dish several days a week. He would have liver dumplings, and the woman who used to prepare his food in the 1930s, Dione Lucas, in her latest cookbook, revealed Hitler's favorite recipe, which was stuffed squab. So squab is not a flying vegetable, it's a pigeon. So there are plenty of eyewitnesses who can, in fact, during the liberation of Poland, I shouldn't say the liberation, but during his conquest of the Nazi invasion of Poland, he celebrated their conquest by eating a Prague ham. So, Czechoslovakia, excuse me, Sudetenland. He celebrated the victory by consuming a Prague ham, and it was taken note of by reporters, and that's all. That's in the historical literature. Mm-hmm. But, unfortunately, historians are not vegetarians, and they don't really know what constitutes a vegetarian diet. They think if you eat vegetables 5 days out of 7, that you can still be a vegetarian. I mean,
I know books now like Vegan Before Six or something. You know, it's
Mark Bittman's book, for example.
Yeah,
but the definitive biographer of Hitler, claims that he said by no stretch, there's no denying that Hitler was a vegetarian, even though he says that except for the occasional lapse, Hitler was a vegetarian. And it's like the other V word, virgin. If you can't be
Hitler is constantly lapsing from his vegetarian diet. Was it Nazi propaganda put out that he was vegetarian? Was that who started it, and why did it make him seem more popular?
Well,
Gandhi
was a great figure on the world stage at that time, and so Goebbels was trying to make Hitler, pattern him after Gandhi, and make Hitler seem to be a Gandhi-esque, a fascistic Gandhi, in a way, that he was self-denying and that he was abstemious, like Gandhi, and he's making him into a fascistic Gandhi for propaganda purposes.
Rin, we're out of time. How can people locate your books?
They're all on Amazon.
It's Rin Berry, R-Y-N-N, Berry, like the berry, B-E-R-R-Y. Thank you so much for an interesting discussion today. I really appreciate it.
Great to be on your show, and best wishes for the holiday season.
Thank you. Rin
Berry. We'll all be celebrating with Vegan Repel.
All vegan. GoVeganRadio.com. It's Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden. GoVeganRadio.com. Green light, time to go vegan, that is, and Green Light Meals makes it easier than ever with great tasting, nutritious meals delivered right to your door wherever you are in the USA. Green light, time to go to the website, greenlightmeals.com, which is GreenLightMeals.com. You care about animals and the environment, and you want your family on the road to better health? Well, go with Green Light Meals. Check out the menu at greenlightmeals.com. Breakfast choices include tofu scramble, breakfast burritos, banana walnut pancakes, Cinnabon oatmeal, lots more on the website. Entrees including chipotle falafel with sweet potato burrito, baked bean and veggie chili, tofu fritters with hot pepper relish, root vegetable soup, lentil soup, stuffed peppers, even vegan barbecued chicken, beefless stew, and buffalo cauliflower. And a lot more snacks, from jerky to trail mix to peanut butter cups. For the kids, how about chickpea tenders with dipping sauce or mac and trees? Greenlight Meals even delivers delicious smoothies. How about blueberry lemon zest or carrot cake or strawberry shortcake or peanut butter and jelly, or lots more. Just check out the website and see. And yes, gift certificates are available. There's a meal plan that's right for you. And when you sign up for one, you'll accelerate your fitness and weight loss goals with consultation and workout plans from Melissa Bray, who is Greenlight Meals fitness and nutrition consultant and NCCPT certified personal trainer and nutritionist with a culinary arts degree from Johnson and Wales University. So now there's nothing stopping you from going vegan. You don't even have to go anywhere. Just go to your front door, the door at your office there. Just go to greenlightmeals.com, and that is a great gift idea. sorry to say there's, you know, once again, I'm so disappointed in the Humane Society of the United States with its terrible gift idea, which I started mentioning last week, which you find on the Humane Society of the United States Farmer Outreach page or Farmer Outrage page. And it suggests that you buy this coffee table book, Great Ranches of the West. And all of these ranches seem to be cow killers. How can this be? Well, it's, you know, become obvious that HSUS is a rancher advocacy organization. I don't really understand how any vegans can support it, you know, in any way anymore. Here in California, it highlights the Lacey Family Ranch, cow killers in Owens Valley in East Central California. It's a book about cattle. Here's one. I lived in Omaha for 3 years, worked at Z92, played all those artists who are canceling their gigs at SeaWorld. Haythorne Land and Cattle Company near Ogallala, Nebraska. Black Angus cattle, foundation bred quarter horses. So you can buy frozen semen from stallions there. And I must say, the photography in this book, as I look at it, the animals look terrified. And then, as I mentioned last week, there's Chain Ranch Outfitters in Oklahoma. At that ranch, in this book, recommended by the Humane Society of the United States, you can go hunting, and you can choose the animal you're guaranteed to kill, so that must be a canned hunt, I would think, huh? It costs you $100 to kill a hog. It says here on the website, a black buck, $2,500, buffalo, $4,000, elk, $1,800 and up, fallow, $2,000. Let's see, and water buffalo, $4,000. You can kill a zebra in a book recommended by the Humane Society of the United States for a mere $3,500. And I might point out that all of these ranches, you know, all of these so-called farms are family farms. You know, I mean, there's this whole movement. Oh, we have to, end factory farms. Well, family farms are just as bad. You know, that farm, the Weiss Brothers farm in Wrightstown, Wisconsin, where all the cheeseheads are. Yep, that was the farm that lost the DiGiorno contract. That was another family farm, you know. So what were they doing? They were smacking or kicking the cows? What about raping and killing them? That doesn't seem to bother us, huh? Okay, it's Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden. We have Animal Rights Commentary with Professor Gary Francione coming up. It's Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden, goveganradio.com. And we begin our animal rights commentary with Professor Gary Francione.
You know, Bob, this morning you sent me a link to a YouTube talk that Peter Singer gave, and you directed me to a point in the presentation where he says that he would use mice in an experiment, that the hypothetical was given to him about whether it would be all right to use mice in an experiment, and he basically says yes, if you could get this if you could cure this illness or whatever he was talking about, yes, it would be morally justifiable to use the mice. And I assume the reason you sent that to me was that you thought what he said was surprising. But it's actually not surprising at all. This is the thing that people just don't realize. I've made the point before that I've met lots of people who own the book Animal Liberation. I've met very few people who have either read it or read it and understood what Singer was saying. That he is He's a utilitarian. He does not believe in rights, and he believes that animals, the lives of animals, have lesser moral value than the lives of humans. He thinks that animal suffering matters, but he thinks that animal lives basically don't have much moral value, certainly lesser value than humans do. And he thinks that it's all right to make trade-offs and to use animals for human purposes. He just doesn't think we should do it as much as we do, and perhaps as brutally as we do. But he certainly is not somebody who is who has ever argued for the abolition of animal exploitation. When I started the blog abolitionistapproach.com, which I started in November of 2006, the very first essay I wrote was called "Peter Singer Supports Vivisection. Why Are You Surprised?" And I'll just read to you the beginning of this essay. The Sunday Times in the UK, November 26, 2006, reports that in a BBC documentary, Peter Singer, described by the Times as the, quote, father of the modern animal rights movement, end quote, meets with Tipu Aziz, an Oxford vivisector who uses primates in his research on Parkinson's disease. Aziz informs Singer that he has induced Parkinson in primates and claims that his use of 100 monkeys has helped 40,000 humans. Singer replies, "Well, I think if you put a case like that, clearly I would have to agree that it was a justifiable experiment. I do not think you should reproach yourself for doing it, provided, I take it you're the expert on this, not me, that there was no other way of discovering this knowledge. I could see that as justifiable research." So, I mean, he's been taking this position for years. The YouTube piece that you sent me this morning
is very recent from Harvard. Do people not evolve in their thinking when somebody talks liberation? But then, you know, I guess the question that was posed to him was, you know, the FDA required. So he said, well, the FDA should change its regulations and not require testing and allow drugs the cancer drugs to be tested on terminal cancer patients. But he says, I'm not an absolutist in that sense, saying that it's never justifiable to test the substance on non-human animals, we should minimize the suffering, but if the expected value can really be great, then it is justified, he says.
Yeah, but I mean, look, he doesn't think, this is an interview with him in 2009. This is a quote from Singer. "You could say it's wrong to kill a being whenever a being is sentient or conscious. Then you would have to say it's just as wrong to kill a chicken or a mouse as it is to kill you or me. I can't accept that idea. It may be just as wrong, but millions of chickens are killed every day. I can't think of that as a tragedy on the same scale as millions of human beings being killed. What is different about humans? Humans are forward-looking beings, and they have hopes and desires for the future. That seems a plausible answer to the question of why it's so tragic when humans die. And by implication, why it's not tragic when animals die, because they don't have a sense of the future. They're not self-aware in the same way that we are." I mean, he is about as clear gets, on this issue. And in the piece that you sent me this morning, I thought he was talking about mice. Maybe I'm incorrect.
He was talking about mice.
Yeah.
Yes.
And you know, he's talking about testing these drugs or whatever, and he's saying that basically, well, you know, if the FDA requires it, and you think it's going to be a good thing to do, and you're going to get benefits from it, then it's all right to do. But he's been taking that position forever. It's not, you know, I mean, he's been taking the position, that position forever. I mean, he basically thinks, what's interesting to me is that he thinks the non-human great apes have a sense of self-awareness, so therefore it's similarly bad, not the same thing, but it's similarly bad to use them as resources in the same way that it would be to use a normal human as a resource. But he didn't have any problem with the non-human primates that the guy at Oxford was using. Now, I don't believe they were non-human great apes. I think that they were primates, but they weren't great apes. They weren't chimpanzees or bonobos or orangutans. But nevertheless, I mean,
but
he thought that trade-off was fine.
He doesn't question. He doesn't. I'm sorry. He doesn't question like the false science of vivisection either. That you know you can't extrapolate from a mouse, or you know look at all the failures of drugs and the drug recalls. He's just kind of okay with the testing, and he's not even questioning the validity of such experiments, which he should be doing.
Look. I think that's a hard one to win. I agree completely. I think vivisection is voodoo science, but. You know, if that's how you're going to link the argument, or how you're going to pose the argument, you're always going to be up against people who have greater scientific credentials who are going to say, well, you know, yes, this is absolutely necessary. You don't understand, blah blah blah. And so, why fight it on that? I mean, my view is, look, let's accept that there are some uses of animals that will get us data that we won't be able to get any other way, and that you know that there's some epistemologically good use of animals in research. My view is I don't care; it's still wrong. You know, I mean it. And so I think that that's the argument. That's the thing that I really like to focus on is look, assuming for argument purposes that there is a use for animals that will give us data that we wouldn't otherwise get, and we need to get that data. I mean, as I say, I want to preface it by saying I believe that vivisection is voodoo science, but I don't think you can ever, you know, it's the same thing when you're talking about the health argument with veganism. Do I talk about the health argument with veganism? Yes, absolutely. Do I believe that a healthy vegan diet is better than eating animal foods? The answer is I think it's absolutely clear that the data are absolutely clear that a healthy vegan diet is better than a diet that contains animal foods. But you know what? You can get stuck talking about the health argument that it's so much better to eat a vegan diet. I think
but,
it is.
But we're but always you know right. We're always right on morality, though, right?
Yeah, I mean that's the moral point is the point to stick with. It's wrong to eat animal foods. Even if you won't be healthier eating a vegan diet, which I believe you will if it's a sound vegan diet, you're certainly not going to be less healthy. You certainly don't need to eat animal products. And so why do that? With the use of animals in vivisection, I think you can easily, you know, brush away most uses of animals as just ridiculous, as you know, in terms of the scientific validity. But there might be some uses that are difficult to get around. And the answer is, I don't care. You know, you can come up with any hypothetical you want and say, you know, if I use these 10 primates, I'll find a cure for cancer. Well, first of all, that's a stupid hypothetical because that's not the way science works. But let's assume, for argument purposes, it did. And you say, well, you know, I can find a cure for cancer if I could kill these animals. The answer is no. It wouldn't be morally right. In the same way that it wouldn't be morally right to take 10 human beings to find a cure for cancer and subject them to an experiment in which they would be, subjected to pain or killed or whatever.
Gary, I have a question on, you know, so the idea being that, you know, animals don't matter as much because humans would plan vacations in the future or want to go to graduate school or things like that. But who are we to say? I mean, animals give birth, they have families, many families stay together for life. Who are we to say that they really don't have interests for the future? You know,
They do, Bob, but you know what? It doesn't mean a big part of my argument is, it doesn't matter, because even if they are stuck in an eternal present, like Peter thinks most of them are, even if that's true, I don't think it is true, but even if it is true, they value themselves in that instant, in that moment, from moment to moment to moment to moment. They want to get to the next moment of consciousness. So I don't really care whether they can think ahead, you know, down the road, well, you know, I've just had a litter of squirrels or whatever, and they're going to do this and they're going to do that. I mean, whether they think that way, I don't really care. My guess is that, you know, they do have some forward-looking act. They have to have. It's sort of hard to explain animal behavior without positing some sort of forward-looking cognition. I don't know what it would be like, because I don't know what it's like for animals to think, because they don't use symbolic communication. They don't use language. I use language. All of my concepts are linked to these things called words and whatnot, as are yours. I don't know how animals think, but do they think? Absolutely. And do they look? Do they plan ahead? My guess is they must. But even if they didn't, even if they were stuck in the eternal present, you know, they just live moment to moment to moment to moment to moment, that still fine. And for purposes of saying they're self-aware, they're aware of themselves in that second. They value their lives in that second. And we have no right to treat them as our resources. I mean, Bob, think about people who there are people who have transient global amnesia who are stuck in an eternal present. They don't have memories of the past. They don't have plans for the future. Now, you know, is that morally relevant? It might be under some circumstances. If you're looking to hire a history professor, it's probably not a good idea to hire somebody who's got transient global amnesia. But if the question is, who do you use in a biomedical experiment, you know, in a painful biomedical experiment, whose organs do you take out to save other people, the normal person or the person with transient global amnesia? And the answer is you don't use either of them. And that's where I think Peter's whole notion that the moral value of animals is linked to whether they have human-like self-awareness is itself a speciesist criterion.
Gary, we're out of time. I guess they build a nest not knowing there's a future life in the nest either. So we're running out of time. Come back next week, yes?
I shall. I've got something to talk to you about next week that's very important.
Okay, abolitionistapproach.com. Eat Like You Care, the new book, Professor Gary Francione. Thank you so much. It's Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden, goveganradio.com. Please support us with a donation. We have to purchase radio airtime. There are production costs. We have to spread this vegan message here. I mean, it's like the job of Go Vegan Radio to protect the world, protect your children. Your government won't do it. So basically, we do that by eating the most delicious, nutritious foods. And I do want to recommend Vegetarian House in San Jose as one of the best vegan restaurants you'll find anywhere. 100% vegan, organic, GMO-free. And just check out the menu at vegetarianhouse.us. See the international menu there, and you'll see that vegans sacrifice nothing. Well, we don't, especially don't sacrifice animals, but it's a wonderful restaurant and also available for catering in the San Francisco Bay Area. Number of dot-coms, Silicon Valley companies have taken advantage of the wonderful food there. So if you have a business event coming up or a wedding, get in touch with Vegetarian House. Again, the website is vegetarianhouse.us. And yes, it is my responsibility to protect your children. Interestingly enough, this story has made it now. I see on CBS This Morning with the warning why you should be especially careful when handling raw chicken. CBS reports on Consumer Reports researchers' findings that 97% of 310 raw chicken breasts bought in supermarkets in 26 states around the country were contaminated with at least one of six deadly bacteria. And many of the bacteria samples found were resistant to three or more classes of antibiotics, making them resistant to multiple drugs. And so I guess when you go shopping in the supermarket there and you look at all the chicken breasts lined up there, when you see 100 of them lined up, I wish you good luck in picking out the three that aren't contaminated. Urvashi Rangan, the magazine's director of consumer safety and sustainability, told CBS This Morning that regarding foodborne illness, quote, chicken is a major culprit, and regarding so-called organic chickens and chickens with various so-called animal welfare labeling, she said, well, those labels mean nothing about possible contaminants. She said people have to be very vigilant about how chickens chickens are handled. I mean, does this sound like a food to you? Is this something you want your children putting in their mouths? Or is, like if you have chicken in the house, like maybe it's a reason to call hazmat or something. You know, I mean, she says you want to use really careful practices in the kitchen. I mean, you know, like, hey, you know, I think the most careful practice would be don't buy any chicken. You know, I mean, you don't want to put chicken, she says, you don't want to put chicken in the sink and run the faucet water on the body. I mean, you're contaminating your whole kitchen sink. It's insane. And then you need a dedicated cutting board, and that should go right into the dishwasher because, you know, it's filthy, it's contaminated, and you're feeding this to your children? Is this food, or, you know, is it like a radioactive substance, you know? I mean, is this, it's like, you know, maybe you're better off giving your kids, you know, a Fukushima smoothie or something, you know? So, in the high cost of cheap chicken, the Consumer Reports report does tell us the average American eats 83 pounds of chicken every year. 48 million Americans get sick from food tainted by Salmonella, E. coli, Campylobacter, and others. Most deaths from these contaminations are caused by poultry consumption. USA Today this week has been reporting on the continuing effects of the antibiotic-resistant Salmonella outbreak nationwide, about which we have been reporting for months, all starting in the filth of foster farms. People are still being sickened by that one. Even now, in the month of December, people are getting sick from the foster farms' continued contamination, even though animal welfare approved, right? So we are up to at least 416 people, illnesses in 23 states, all because people mistake chickens for food. So I don't know what to tell you here other than... what did the USDA food safety inspector say? It's not feasible to take a live animal and remove its outsides and insides without there being contamination. Don't feed chicken to your children. Love animals. Don't eat them. Go vegan.